Today on Against the Grain, what's the point of education? The prevailing wisdom today is that children need to be prepared for eventually joining the job market, and that an investment in schools is an investment in the future productivity of the country. But what would schooling look like if the value of education was not monetary, but something deeper, such as the child's lifelong well-being and happiness? Developmental psychologist Susan Engel will join me to discuss why training shouldn't be confused with education. She'll also explore alternatives to seeing the economy as the endpoint of schooling. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Schools these days are supposed to solve all our social ills, addressing the huge learning and wealth gap between poor and affluent families, and churning out employable adults who will grow the economy. Educational success is frequently measured by notions like return on investment. Given the amount of money put into a school, how economically productive or well-paid are the children who come out of them once they reach adulthood? But are these expectations and paradigms all wrong? Shouldn't the goal of learning be to live a life that's emotionally and intellectually, rather than financially, rich? Developmental psychologist Susan Engel argues that today's reigning philosophy is shortchanging kids, often turning them off learning for life. She's the author of The End of the Rainbow: How Educating for Happiness, Not Money, Would Transform Our Schools. That's published by the New Press. She teaches in the Department of Psychology at Williams College. Susan, the conventional wisdom about children in America seems to be all over the map. On the one hand, there are tropes about children being coddled by over-involved helicopter parents. And yet, on the other, there's intense anxiety about America having slipped in educational rankings and the expectations of how dire this is going to be in the future. Can you give us a sense of the reality of children in America today?
First of all, there's a different narrative for poor children and children of underrepresented groups than there is for the white middle-class child, who typically is the one that people are talking about when they talk about helicopter parenting, or there's some new phrase about snowplow parenting or something like that. And so for those white middle-class parents that narrative is about, I would say that there is this kind of sort of blown up sense that they are overprotected, that they need to be coddled in every way, that their parents are rushing to make sure they get first in everything. And to some extent, I think that is true, though it's not all about a kind of sentimental adoration of childhood. Some of it is linked to what you said at the end, which is a kind of underlying worry that everybody has to be at the top of the list or get the A+ or whatever. It's a kind of, I don't know, a social, this shared sense that everything's a race. But I do think it's true that the media and the conversations around the dinner table and in schools is all about sort of these precious young kids. But those are white middle-class kids, in my view. Meanwhile, I think that it's pretty clear that as a nation, we don't have that same concern for children who aren't white and aren't middle class. And that comes across in all kinds of ways. We're perfectly happy to let most kids eat terrible food. We're perfectly happy to let most kids go to schools that are ugly. They're not just under-equipped with proper bathrooms and books or you know, fancy playground equipment. They're drab. They are not a nice place to be. Why would we send children to spend the bulk of their day in these dismal and often overcrowded buildings if we really cared about their experience? So there are two different narratives. The one thing that I think they both have in common is that somehow, although schooling for the most privileged kids is different than for the least privileged kids, and our values about that and our goals about that are different, they have in common this one big mistake, which is that we're under-educating both groups.
So let's talk specifically about how both groups are being undereducated. Let's start with a smaller group, which is the privileged children.
Right.
How are they being educated, and how is that education relentlessly, as you're arguing, geared toward the idea that they should be ready to eventually take elite jobs and be uber producers in the economy?
Right, great term. Well, it has to do with this fixation on acquiring certain pre-professional skills. So every time I go to a conference where they talk about educating for the 21st century, it's the assumption underneath that is that there's something kids are going to have to do in the 21st century, I mean, when they become grown-ups, that is different than they did in the past. And that may be true. I mean, you know, it may be that the kinds of work that are most interesting, most viable, most needed, you know, going forward are different than the ones that were so valuable or important 50 or 100 years ago. But underneath that is the sense that that's what K-12 education is about, getting you ready for work, which is not at all the same as helping you become a well-educated person. So that's the big picture of how we miseducate them. It plays out in very concrete and upsetting ways. We push them relentlessly to acquire certain math skills, even though those aren't necessarily skills that they will, that they enjoy getting, that will expand their minds, or even actually that will be useful to most of them. So they, most kids spend a lot of time doing math that isn't even very good math, and they do it for a purpose other than becoming sort of well-educated or thoughtful about the world of numbers. That's just one example. A second example is our push for all kids to get better and better test scores. And again, the assumption is that that makes them and the nation competitive in some way, but there's almost no evidence that those test scores in and of themselves either predict or lead to a more thoughtful person, a person who likes to read more, a person who's more able to engage in informed conversation, a person who's more willing to change their mind in the face of new evidence. Those are things that I consider to be the characteristics of a well-educated person, and they're extremely important. It's not as if they're not every bit as valuable and substantive as work skills. They're just a different set of skills, and they end up getting pushed to the side by because of our focus, this sort of relentless focus on these more concrete work-related skills.
And then how does this focus on the goal of education being work or preparing people to play a role in the economy, how does that shape the education of the much larger group of students out there who are poorer and many of them of color and operating often in segregated schools?
Yeah. Well, it's such a big, complicated, dreary story. So I have to say right at the outset, because often people misunderstand me about this, that I am not challenging the idea that education improves the prospects of people who are poor or who have been historically denied access to good things in life. There's no question. You can look at that internationally as well as within the country. When people go to school, everything about their lives gets better. They get sick less. They have more employment options. In the long run, because of that, they tend to stay married longer and be more likely to own a home. And all kinds of good things come from going to school. And the more school, the better in that sense. That said, what happens to you in school is a different matter. And so far, we've, again, been so certain that the thing we need to do, and what by we in that sentence I mean the sort of educational establishment, is make sure that minority children or children who are poor kind of catch up with these measurable skills, you know, a good math score or a good whatever spelling test, that, again, we ignore their right to love books, to think about interesting ideas, to engage in pursuits that are meaningful to them, to get really good at things that they choose to get really good at. So again, we push all that to the side with this added sense that we're not, it's not like the white upper middle class kid where we're pushing them relentlessly to seek the more and more lucrative job. Instead, we're saying that if these other kids don't even get these basic skills, they'll never move on in life. And it's just it's a misconstruction of the facts. It's true that all kids need and deserve the right to become educated, but the million-dollar question in there is, what does it mean to be educated? And we've developed this schooling system where we think that, you know, so I teach at Williams College, and I would say by and large the assumption is the kids who come to Williams are capable of and deserve to, you know, get this great, rich, liberal arts education. And I think they do, but I think all kids do. And I don't think that's a luxury. I think it's a necessity in, you know, for an enlightened, you know, peaceful, civil community.
Well, obviously there are many different opinions that are proffered around this question, but what would you say really dominates the conversation when people define the meaning of education? Is there some consensus amongst policymakers that one tends to hear of, you know, what that actually means?
Gosh, that's a great question. And, you know, I don't spend enough time with policymakers to know the real answer to that.
Sure.
But my experience, my sense from being in Washington and talking to some policymakers sometimes, but also reading the newspaper and talking to parents and school administrations, is that people are all over the place about it, that very few people give it really careful thought. And it's why, you know, in my book, The End of the Rainbow, I go to some length to define what I think a real education is. And it's because I think mostly people don't think that deeply about it. And so they accept, I mean, I'll just give you one example. I wrote a piece a year or two ago in a newspaper questioning the idea that all children should have to take math as it's currently taught in our public school system. And I was suggesting that some of the kinds of math that kids do is not interesting to them. It doesn't lead to an interest in more math, and it doesn't give them any sort of more powerful intellectual skills than they had in the first place. It just teaches them how to do those particular kinds of math, which only are useful if you're going to take the next course in math. You know what I mean? It's just its own track. And people were so outraged by that, except for the mathematicians I knew, and as well as Andrew Hacker, who then wrote a book about it, about what a myth it is, that all kids need to take that very narrowly defined sequence of math courses. And the reason I bring it up is the fact that everyone thought it was so blasphemous of me to say that was because I don't think they had think very deeply about what kids actually might get out of that sequence of math courses that's the conventional sequence. So I would say that people are all over the place. They think that education is to make good workers. Sometimes you'll hear people talk about critical thinking, and I guess that might be a good idea, but I'm not sure that people agree on what critical thinking really is. And certainly the way that I define it as a psychologist, it's very hard to find signs of that kind of thinking going on in school. So it's a lot of conventions that have just been inherited over time and without being questioned. And, you know, you go into most schools and you'll see some wonderful mission statements about, you know, we want kids to be lifelong learners. But it's not clear that anybody's really thought about how they would know a lifelong learner when they met one, or what it would require in the K-12 setting to ensure that people become lifelong learners. So there's kind of a disconnect between the big statements people make about education and what really goes on in schools.
Susan Engel is my guest. She's a developmental psychologist and author of The End of the Rainbow, How Educating for Happiness, Not Money, Would Transform Our Schools. And that's published by the New Press. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, your book really goes into depth on how this notion about the value of schooling and the emphasis on the word value, that there's an economic or monetary value that schooling should be able to produce. You make the argument that that is really incredibly influential and really dominates so much thinking around education today. And although I want to ask you about more recent times, I'm curious to know what you think is the origin of this turn in America toward seeing the point of education to be primarily anyway about preparing people for the work world ahead of them.
Gladly, but, you know, I should just say, I should put a little dose of humility in here. I'm not an historian. I came to this, what I'm about to say, just by trying to answer the question you just asked me, which I had in my head, like, how did we get here? And, you know, if you look back, education as we know it, sort of reading and thinking about ideas and thinking about evidence and numbers and knowing, being familiar with various works of art in different domains, all of that was the province of the privileged. And school meant not at work, you know, at leisure. And the idea was that to be enlightened, to pursue ideas, was something that only privileged people got to enjoy. And then, you know, in the, I guess, the 19th century, as we industrialized, and by we, I mean the United States, but plenty of other countries too, there became this need to have kids be in school. Partly there was nowhere for else for them to be as their parents went out of the home to work. And part of it was because of industrialization, there were a set of skills that somehow we thought every kid could get through school. So that was, in my sort of naive, amateur historical view, that's part of how that emerged. And then the more and more kids that we thought we should educate, a weird thing happened. Instead of thinking, okay, there are all these kids that we never thought of as going to school, you know, poor kids, what used to be called Indian children or black kids, girls, now that they were coming into the schools, especially in our urban centers, instead of thinking that means that everybody can love ideas and become familiar with novels and poetry and learn to think about evidence, we sort of did this weird little twist and said, okay, now that all those people are in school, let's make it vocational. And I don't think that was I don't think a group of people sat down and made that decision on a given day. I don't think it was a conscious decision. I think it was a slow sort of slide into that perspective. And then I think actually it's been intensified in recent years. Again, it's sort of ironic, you know, that you probably a lot of your listeners already know this, but the phrase No Child Left Behind was originally a phrase coined by Marion Wright Edelman from the Children's Defense Fund. And it meant, you know, why should some children not have the good things that the other kids are getting? But it got turned by the educational establishment, mostly by the government, I think, into a set of tools that has done the opposite. It's made every child left behind, in a sense. And again, I go back to the idea, left behind what? So one question is, who's left behind economically? But there's also the question of who's cheated of the chance to be a thinker, to be a sort of lively member of society with all that that entails.
I'd like to ask you more about No Child Left Behind and where things stand now, but you write about how the progressive educator John Dewey, who was born in the mid-19th century and died in the mid-20th century, how his ideas about children and education were adopted after his death in a way that sort of took them, made them go awry. Can you tell us what his ideas were and then trace out for us the shift?
He was such a great thinker. So anybody listening who's looking for some good reading should read John Dewey. And he noticed then what you could still notice now when you walk into a classroom, which is how disconnected most of the material and most of the activities are from the things that really concern children. And he identified something which developmental psychologists have subsequently shown is true with evidence, which is that from the get-go, from the time children are babies, they are dying to be like the grown-ups in their society. They're dying to be part of things. They study the way grown-ups behave or older children behave. They listen to what they say. They are interested in helping out with various tasks, which is not to say that they're exactly like older children and adults. That would be terrible of me to say as a developmental psychologist, but they are made to want to be part of society, part of the group. And yet, as John Dewey noticed and wrote about, when we send them to school, we sort of cut them off from all of that and say, oh, yeah, so interesting things are going on. People are making things and arguing and voting and working, but you go into that room and do something that's boring and stale and just involves a piece of paper and a pencil. And we'll see you in about, 15 years. And he argued against that, and he said, children, yearn to learn about things that are meaningful to them, and that what's meaningful to them is often whatever's connected to society. And it was through that idea that he came to this notion of occupations in the classroom. So in the original lab school in Chicago that he started, there were four occupations. I always forget them. One was carpentry, one was sewing, one was cooking, and there was, I'm pretty sure, a fourth, which I forget. But it was never his intention that kids do those things in school so that they could become good carpenters and seamstresses and tailors and cooks. It was his idea that through those socially meaningful, valuable activities or work, kids would learn about their culture, learn about the economies, the mathematics, the stories, the meanings of their society. So it was an incredibly beautiful articulation of what it means to connect the world of enlightenment, of ideas, of knowledge, with the world of experience, the things you do. And, a person who's written about that really eloquently in modern life is Luc Menand. He talks about it at the college level, but in my view, I think he would agree, it's the same idea. And you see it in some colleges now, this focus on experiential education. And when it's done right, it's the same concept Dewey had, that through these engaging, sort of absorbing, meaningful activities, kids would think and know in increasingly powerful ways. So it was the opposite of sort of separating the world of thought and ideas from the world of action. It was saying, that they go together. And anybody who's been around a kid can see why that's such a great idea for education, K-12 education. Kids love to be active. They love to make things. They love to express themselves. They love to invent. And so why wouldn't they become more thoughtful and more knowledgeable in the context of doing those things?
And then how did that end up giving some heft to a much more narrow vocational notion of education, that the point of education was to create workers and grow the economy?
Well, I think there are two ways it did. One was just what you just said. So it sort of weirdly paralleled. So I was talking before about how as we educated more and more kids and more kinds of kids in terms of their backgrounds, we began to water down our idea of what an education should entail. So, to be totally unfiltered, I think it had to do with this really deep and possibly implicit idea that there were some kids who couldn't be intellectuals, and particularly kids who were from minority backgrounds, or this assumption that if you were poor, it meant you couldn't really think or love a book or, put together a good sentence. So there was this assumption that the more different kinds of kids who went to school, the less intellectual it should be, and the more value there would be in teaching kids work, and that's where vocational programs came from, which I think there are a lot of people who really support the idea of vocational education, and it sort of sounds compelling when you first hear it. It's like, yeah, if a kid doesn't really love to learn history or do algebra, why not let them do something they'll love, like shop, car mechanics, or carpentry. And that's not what Dewey had in mind at all. So that's one way in which the vocational kind of lost the sense that Dewey had for it. And the other was, it happened just as often in the sort of nicest, most progressive schools, which is people just didn't really understand Dewey. So they thought as long as the kid was cooking or making something in the woodworking corner, they were doing what John Dewey had in mind, and it's just not the case. It's much sort of subtler and more complex than that. It's why it takes a really great teacher to get a kid to be a thinker through the work that they do at the woodworking shop or at the sand table or, you know, at the kitchen counter. It's not as simple as just letting them do stuff. You know, the obsession I find with this phrase project-based learning has to do with this same misconstrual, which is that as long as a kid is doing a project, it's progressive, it's sort of informed by Dewey. And I guess I just don't think that's true. I think projects are more fun than worksheets, and they're better because kids like to do stuff. But if you really want a child to learn how to, which is what Dewey had in mind, to think about what he or she is doing or connect what he or she is doing to the broader world of things that others have done before him or her, then there's some really good teaching that has to happen as well.
Susan Engel is my guest. We'll return with her in a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Susan Engel about her book, The End of the Rainbow, How Educating for Happiness, Not Money, Would Transform Our Schools. That's published by the New Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. She teaches in the Department of Psychology at Williams College, and her many books include Real Kids and The Hungry Mind. So you were talking about the evolution of this notion going back 150 years from some deep societal changes that shaped the idea that the main purpose of education is to produce workers who are able to get into the job market, increase the economy, and so on. And I wanted to ask you if you think taking the story up to the present, or let's say to the last several decades, do you think there's also something that, I know you're not a historian, as you said, but social shifts that have also made parents feel much more financially insecure, economically insecure, and therefore ready to applaud the notion or support the notion that schools should be about preparing people for the job market, and therefore, although there's a continuity from, you know, the last century and a half, something more intense has been going on in the last several decades. And then economists and the media in many ways have also added to the picture. But just staying with that for a moment, that there is a kind of pervasive sense of insecurity.
You know, I hear that and see that, you know, frequently. And I just don't know, because from my, as I said, really amateurish understanding of history, people have always been insecure. I mean, if you think about the sources of such insecurity, now a lot of people are worried about their jobs, but first of all, for many people, that's always been true. Many more people, from what I understand, worldwide lived close to armed conflict 100 years ago. Many more of us were more vulnerable to more kinds of disease. So maybe that's true, but I'm not sure it's true. So that's one thing I would say. I mean, and certainly if you lived in this country in the 40s and 50s, there were a lot of reasons to be very insecure in terms of World War II and then sort of the emergence of nuclear threats. So when I was a little girl, that's what I was scared of. The idea that because we're more insecure, that's why schools are more focused on helping kids make money. Well, maybe, because certainly maybe the source of insecurity now is economic as opposed to about being about war or disease.
Could possibly, though, the difference, I think you're making a very fair point about the insecurity of the past, but now also one shift is that in terms of the more pervading conventional wisdom about how one deals with things, in earlier times, at least going back to the mid-20th century, there was a kind of presumption of a more collective way of handling things, whereas now there is a more individualized notion, and so it is seen as people's lot to have to deal with things themselves.
You know, that could be. I mean, and that brings up something I wanted to mention before. It's just such a shame, because if ever there were a time, God knows the current election cycle shows this, if there were ever a time when people needed to be able to come together, this is it. And that's the other piece that I want to say about sort of, let's say, just think about parents for a minute and their anxieties, whatever their backgrounds, about their kids' ability to get a job or keep a job. I get that. I have three sons who are all in, you know, their 20s. Well, actually, the eldest is 32 now. So I totally understand one's anxiety about one's kids. Will they make it? Will they get a job? Will they be able to support themselves? Will they be happy? All of that. But the irony of all of this is that actually, if we were to shift our educational goals a little bit, we wouldn't be harming kids' chance of getting a good job. In fact, I would argue we'd be vastly enhancing it. And everywhere I go, especially, honestly, in Silicon Valley near you, if you listen to what people say about the future of work, the things that kids need or that they will need are a set of dispositions and ways of approaching the world that have nothing to do with whether they take Algebra 2 or ace the vocabulary test or, you know, God knows whatever else. I mean, so much of what kids do in school right now, in its worst version, is not germane to anything. It's not going to make them more thoughtful, and it's also not going to make them necessarily better at doing a job. The one thing that I think schools try very hard to do that is employment-related that they may be successful at is to become compliant. And that, and the poorer or more underrepresented, a group a kid is from, the more emphasis there is on compliance. And I don't think it's a good educational goal. But it may serve the purposes of some industries.
Well, it does raise the question whether the whole focus on a kind of very narrow sort of education, and I will talk about alternatives to the way that schooling is done now. But,
oh, good.
You know, but given what you're saying about how so much of schooling really doesn't give children very much at all,
yeah.
You know, a cynical voice might say, well, is this really ultimately a result of a society where a lot of people are destined, a large segment anyway, of the population, that is those people who are getting the worst schooling of all,
yeah,
for low-wage service, yeah, sector jobs?
Well, it may be, and I have heard other people say that, and I'm ready to believe that. The thing that I would argue, and I'm not alone in this, the philosopher Harry Brighouse talks about this, is that, you know, I said I wasn't an historian, I'm also not an economist, and so I don't really understand exactly what the future of work is in this country or anywhere, and I'm not quite sure I understand sort of what it would be better for people to set their sights on in terms of employment. Well, I do know one thing, because I am a psychologist. Whether you have a menial job or a challenging job, whether you are working, I don't know whether there will be factories in the future, whatever. Either way, your life will be better and your contribution to society will be better if you're thoughtful, if you go on learning, if you can understand what other people are saying to you, if you can change your mind. So the goals that I think school should have will be better for people, I think, regardless of what their employment future is likely to be. And so it may be that the system we have now is sort of meant to keep people down. That's a sort of crude way of putting it. But even if it's true that not everyone, you know, I mean, because it would be silly for me to predict or speculate that in 50 years everybody's going to have a wonderful, challenging, satisfying job. I have no idea about that. I know that either way, whether everyone will or won't, their life will be better if they're actually well-educated. And they'll probably be better at most jobs as well. So they actually go hand in hand. I'm not asking people to give up the notion that their kids will do well at a job. I just think that will happen that's more likely even to happen, and they're more likely to live better lives and be better members of society if they're educated rather than trained at school.
Well, let's talk about what that would look like. What would it actually look like in practice to have the ultimate goal of education be happiness, and you define happiness not as sort of fleeting pleasure, but
right.
a sort of deep sense of fulfillment. What might it look like?
Well, so one of the things that I came to realize as I wrote the book, The End of the Rainbow, was that one way to shift education is to rethink the goals. And here I mean not just the goals that teachers carry around in their mind and parents, but the things we measure. So instead of measuring how a kid does on a math test, you might measure how much they like to read. And instead of measuring, you know, their ability to, I don't know, summarize some section of a book, you might measure their ability to engage in a sustained and deep conversation, which I see as, you know, conversations being at sort of the center of a good society, of a civilized society. And if you made things like good conversation and inquiry and collaboration and the ability to pursue mastery, those are four of the things I talk about in the book. If you made those not just sort of the icing on the cake, the thing on the mission statement on the wall, but the sort of measurable goals that all teachers were seeking, you'd see kids in classrooms having conversations with one another and grown-ups. You'd see teachers making time for that and helping kids get better, quote-unquote, at it, meaning more open-minded, more informed, more willing to stick with a conversation when there's disagreement. You'd see them giving kids a chance to talk about things they really wanted to talk about, like I said, with another child, with a group, with a grown-up. Same thing for reading. You'd be amazed at how many times I go into schools, and everybody's working on helping kids with their reading skills, but there's almost no time spent on actually just reading. And there is no question that people are more likely to become readers if they get to spend time reading and reading things they really actually want to read. It sounds so slight when I put it that way, but it would be huge if schools took that seriously. If you went into schools and saw kids, you know, in comfortable positions, actually reading books they chose and cared about, and spending time either talking about the book or reading with somebody else, that could easily take up a big part of the day, and it should, in terms of what's really useful educationally to kids. Another thing that I've done quite a bit of research on, and written a different book about, is the importance of curiosity, the importance of asking questions and then getting a chance to pursue those questions, whether it's with scientific data or conversation or reading or Google. Aside from a psychological perspective, being curious is probably the most powerful motivator for learning in the world. And anybody has only to think about what it's been like when they really want to know something. They found it out. And babies and toddlers are like that as well. And yet we do very little in our schools to build on that, to let kids find out the things they really want to know about. And, you know, instead we tell them what they should know about and then try to sweeten it up by making, you know, it with a pretty picture or a prize at the end of the day. But, you know, prizes pale in comparison as an incentive to learning compared to genuine curiosity. And learning how to inquire takes time, and it takes space in the day. So kids getting a chance to figure out what they want to know and then get help and support in finding ways to answer their own question, and then the big, important, final piece of that is making decisions about whether they've actually gotten their question answered or not. So we tend to tell kids when they've gotten the answer right. And, in fact, in real life, we know when we've answered our question. You know, you can tell when you want to know something and you got a satisfactory answer.
But that sounds like a school where both the pace of the day is entirely different, right?
Yes.
It's not sort of one sequence of things after another driven by the teacher with the students sort of trailing behind. And it also sounds like what you're talking about is something that puts the child's desires in the center of their learning, which seems like it would require kind of a different structure. Is that right?
It would require a different structure. I mean, I will add there that I am not advocating what has been tried at various times in various places as a completely student-centered curriculum. I think, you know, I said earlier, I commented on Dewey's insight that children sort of want to be like grown-ups. So for anybody listening to this who's been around little kids, siblings, their own children, grandchildren, whatever, they know that kids naturally get interested in the things that other people around them are interested in. And when grown-ups are really interested in something, you know, so I love to cook. And no surprise, all my boys, now men, love to cook. I mean, they love to eat, too, but they go hand in hand. And they were around people that liked to cook and liked good food and liked to eat. And so it wasn't surprising that they became interested in cooking. And by the same token, if you have a teacher who really loves books, and has a lively, engaged way of talking about them and choosing them with you, you're likely to become interested in books. There's a good chance, especially since it's so narratives and stories are so naturally, intrinsically appealing to most people. So there's nothing wrong with a classroom or a school where teachers bring in materials, activities. It's a question of what their goal is. If their goal is that every kid better learn about, you know, Richard III, well, that's one goal. If their goal is to get every kid to get engaged in the process of learning about the past, that's a very different goal. And it doesn't exclude the possibility that grown-ups bring in materials, curriculum, whatever you want to call it. It just changes how the teacher would do that and what the purpose of doing that would be. And yet, just to go back to your point, I do think that kids spend a huge amount of time rushing around, and so do their teachers, rushing around from one activity to another so that there's almost no chance for any of those activities to be satisfying, to be pleasurable, to be meaningful. One thing I think everybody would agree on is that it's valuable by the time you're an adult to know how to seek expertise or mastery in something. But we set up the school day so that it's virtually impossible for anybody to get expertise about anything because they're just, the day's so chopped up. So if we really think that's a goal of education, to learn what it's like to become very good at something, we need to give kids a chance to actually spend time getting good at something.
Developmental psychologist Susan Engel is my guest. I'm speaking with her about her book, The End of the Rainbow, How Educating for Happiness, Not Money, Would Transform Our Schools. And I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So if the purpose of schooling were the eventual and maybe current happiness of children, what would the environment look like? And because you started off this interview describing the sort of dismal environment of schools today, how does the school environment and the question of space affect how children learn and, you know, the space to move around in?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and this is something Ted Sizer wrote about, I don't know, it's like 15 or 20 years ago, I forget the name of the book, but you know, it's just shocking to me that we let so many kids go to school in such horrible spaces. And I'm not suggesting that kids, I mean, actually, I don't believe in fancy playground equipment. There's some wonderful research on how much kids benefit from more unstructured, sort of wild and woolly play environments. But on the other hand, every kid deserves to have a window to look out of. and to have some nice natural light and to have a room that's inviting. I mean, a lot of classrooms, they just look like my, and I've never been in the Army, but what an Army barrack would look like, or the worst part of a hospital, and they shouldn't look that way either. But, so, you know, kids just deserve to be, they have deserve to sit in a comfortable chair, they deserve to sit around tables, they deserve to have a conversation and a pleasant environment when they eat lunch. So those are some of the physical characteristics I'm talking about, and actually they deserve to be around beautiful things, art. This is something that, you know, the Reggio Emilia school system has done such a great job of talking about or advertising to the rest of us, which is that kids, you know, they want to make things, but they also love to touch and look and be around beauty. That's a fundamental human capacity that's different, that separates us from all other creatures, as far as I know, our desire for beauty. And yet we don't do much to let kids make their environment beautiful. Not in public schools, anyway. So, and it needn't be fancy. I mean, it should be the opposite of fancy. It doesn't mean you import a lot of special posters or equipment. It means you let kids make their environment beautiful. Why shouldn't that be a part of their educational experience? You know, putting art on the wall, putting their written work on the wall, building sculptures. And there are some schools that look that way. They're just not the norm, and they don't tend to be for everyone. They tend to be for a select few.
You write in The End of the Rainbow that children, poor children, children who tend to be in the worst schools, often are very physically controlled, that children, a lot of the schooling is about keeping them still.
Yeah.
And one of the punishments that has been meted out on children all over the country is if they do things that the teacher doesn't like, they can get recess taken away.
Yeah.
How important do you think is addressing the child physically in the process of education?
Very important. I mean, so, you know, we know from Jean Piaget, who, you know, one could argue is the sort of father or grandfather of developmental psychology, that young children think with their bodies. Before they can sit down and develop a line of argument or speculate about something, they do it physically. And the process, you know, of becoming more and more sort of stationary, not that it's ever good for you, but being able to think about something without acting on it, that takes time. And we also know from Piaget going forward, right up into present day, lots of psychologists talk about this, that kids have a great urge to play. We don't yet fully understand scientifically what all the functions are of such play. We're still trying to figure that out. But there's no question that it's a powerful drive for children and that it allows them all kinds of sort of intellectually and socially important growth. And so the idea of robbing them of play, as some schools have done in order to have more time on tasks, is just terrible. I mean, talk about a sign that you don't really like kids. That's one. So first of all, taking recess away. I mean, the irony of that, by the way, is that often kids who have trouble trouble behaving and following the rules are the ones who need more exercise, not less. And I don't mean calisthenics. I mean running around and jumping and climbing and playing games with other kids. So it just seems cruel and counterproductive to rob children of, in fact, almost all kids that I know of in almost all schools need more playtime than they have.
Well, let me end this interview by asking you about how much possibility there is for a shift in how education takes place. You're arguing to really change the basic premise so that the fulfillment of children as they get older is central. How much wiggle room do schools have to adopt the kind of policies or ideas or kind of goals that you're talking about?
Well, I think they have plenty of wiggle room, lots more than they think. And the reason I say that is I've seen this happen in schools. Many of the things I describe in the book and advocate are happening in individual pockets, either whole schools or classrooms within schools. You know, this takes good teaching, and why shouldn't it? When we come up with new great medical procedures, by and large, we assume that very good doctors will be using them or that they'll be most successful in the hands of good doctors. So there's no reason not to expect that in schools. I also think that the kinds of practices I'm talking about will make good people enjoy teaching, and that's as it should be. It should, these practices will make teaching a more attractive, more rewarding career, and we need that desperately. We need the best people attracted to teaching. So I also would say that nothing I'm talking about is more expensive than what we do now. It's just a shift in what we look for in the classroom and what we look for at the end of the year. It's not more complicated. It's not doesn't require more materials or, you know, it. The most important thing it requires, the biggest thing it requires, is a changed idea of what education should be, and a clear, vivid picture of what that would actually look like in terms of specific practices. But, you know, I'm an optimist, so I think all of that could be done. It could be done in a classroom, in a school, in a whole community, without much trouble, if only people wanted to embrace it, were to jump in and try it. And I honestly, I think there's very little risk. You know, one thing that you implied but didn't, but I want to sort of make really concrete. One of the best things that could happen if we shifted the emphasis in the ways that I'm advocating are that more kids would like being in school. And there's no version of any of this where that isn't a great thing. If we did nothing else, if we made talking and learning and being together in an educational environment, you know, really appealing for most kids, we'd have accomplished 2/3 of our goals right there.
And that is Susan Engel. She is the author of The End of the Rainbow, How Educating for Happiness, Not Money, Would Transform Our Schools. That's published by the New Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's a developmental psychologist and educator. She teaches at Williams College, and her many books include A School of Our Own and The Hungry Mind. Susan, thank you so much for your time today.
Total pleasure talking with you.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.